ask if you'd like to make a 3 to 5 minute opening statement.
I appreciate the opportunity to do that, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I appreciate this opportunity to serve as a regent from the 8th Congressional District. As you know, I live in Walker, where both my wife and I were raised. We left Walker after high school for college and our careers, and I've always maintained very close ties with family and friends, often returning to the cabin we built many years ago. And then after I retired in 2008 from the Wayzata School District Superintendency, we returned to Walker to make our expanded cabin our home. Education has always been extremely important to me. I grew up in an education family and followed my father's footsteps into teaching and administration. After graduating from Bemidji State University with degrees in chemistry and biology, I taught both subjects at Eden Prairie High School for a period of 11 years. After earning my master's degree in science supervision from the University of Virginia, I had a great experience at the University of Minnesota in the late 70s and early 80s as a graduate student in educational administration. After receiving my administrative license, I served in various administrative roles in the Brainerd and Chaska school districts before assuming my first superintendency in Shakopee in 1991. My administrative work includes broad experience in all areas of human resource administration, including the hiring and evaluation process, contract negotiations, and contract administration. I also bring extensive fiscal resource management experience. The position directly responsible for fiscal management has reported to me in every position I have held since 1985. In addition to bottom-line fiduciary responsibility for annual public fund budgets of up to $100 million, I have extensive experience in generating both public and private funds for education and other purposes. I would like to believe that my lobbying efforts over the years in my role as a superintendent and as president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators have increased public funds for education. I have led approximately 15 school district operating levy or bond levy campaigns in 3 different districts, and all have been successful. In my 2-year role as interim headmaster of St. Thomas Academy, I was directly involved in generating significant private donations for school operations and also helped lay the groundwork for a major capital campaign. I served on the St. Francis Hospital Foundation board for several years in the 90s, and during my 2-year service as president, we conducted a major capital campaign for a new hospital. I was particularly pleased with the fact that the proceeds from the successful campaign were directed towards giving the new hospital a softer, less institutional feel through the artwork and other amenities we were able to purchase. Policy development has been an important part of my work. In the Shakopee schools, I led a complete review and restructuring of all school district policies and worked with the board to establish a 3-year review cycle. At St. Thomas Academy, I worked with the board to literally start from scratch and establish the first policy manual in the history of the school. In Wayzata, I oversaw a complete review of all board policies and the implementation of a 3-year policy review cycle. Equity and diversity goals have been an important part of my work, particularly in Shakopee and Wayzata. In Shakopee, we implemented several initiatives to meet the needs of a rapidly growing immigrant student population and their families. In Wayzata, I played a key role in the development, board adoption, and implementation of an equity plan designed to close the student achievement gap. My leadership style places a high value on honesty and integrity. My experience demonstrates that I possess strong interpersonal skills that contribute to mutual respect among all parties. I seem to bring a calming influence to an organization, especially if it's needed. It varies, believe me. I've been successful in every position I've held in building trust between all parties, the board, administration, faculty, staff, and the community. If there were time in this introductory statement, I would cite examples, and I would be happy to do so later if you would like. The last area I'd like to highlight from my experience concerns transitions in leadership. I have personally assumed the top leadership position in an educational organization on 4 occasions, and I believe that my experience with transitions would be of value to the Board of Regents, to the university at this unique time, and to incoming President Dr. Eric Kaler. Again, I would be happy to elaborate on this topic later if you would like. The primary role of the Board of Regents is to establish governance policies to direct the operations of the university and to support the administration in their role of implementing the established policies. It's a role differentiation that I have a tremendous amount of experience with and also great respect for. I also know that as an individual regent, while I would have the responsibility and the honor to represent the university in a variety of ways, individually, I would have no authority. Authority lies only with the entire board. A strong and continually improving University of Minnesota dedicated to educational excellence is critical to our state's future. The university's role in teaching and learning, research, and public outreach to improve the lives of all citizens is fundamentally important to our quality of life. My desire to serve as a regent is driven by my desire to utilize my experience to serve an extremely important public service. The true measure of any region's success is the extent to which the university is successful in meeting its role as the economic engine of our state. As a regent, I would be excited and honored to dedicate my public service efforts to the mission of the University of Minnesota. Thank you, and happy to hear your questions.
Jim Erickson, get the first question.
This is a serious matter, so you're going to get a lot of heavily freighted questions here in the next hour. Let me start with a lighter one. Can you really be as great an American human being as all your references say you are?
I mean, they actually told you what I wrote for them to say.
I'm afraid not. It's nice to hear that.
That's it?
That's a good answer.
Patrick.
Well, I don't know if my question is going to be any more difficult, but we'll try. The mission of the land-grant mission of the University of Minnesota is often referred to as a three-legged stool of research, teaching, and outreach. And I'm going to give you the question with two different time frames in mind. There's an immediate time frame of maybe the next 6 months, or the time frame out 4 or 5 years. And the question is, what do you think is the most significant challenge or threat that the university system faces and that university mission faces? And how do we deal with those threats? And maybe it's the same threat 6 months and 6 years from now, but your comments.
I hope it's not the same threat 6 years from now as it is 6 months from now, because clearly the biggest threat currently is funding. Every institution in our society, public or private, is struggling right now with the economy and the tightening of resources that comes with that. The university certainly is no exception, and it's been that way for quite some time. I'm concerned, as I think I'm sure all of you are, that I believe tuition has increased 100% in the past decade. That's troubling. It's a little less troubling when you understand that financial aid has increased a lot and there's a lot of support there, so that's wonderful. But to deal with funding, to keep the research funding at high levels, which is excellent right now, and I know went up considerably over last year, over 2009 and 2010, so that's wonderful. But to sustain that is critically important. It's such a driver of, the betterment of mankind in areas of healthcare and so many other areas. So I see that funding is key. And as a regent, obviously you have a role in trying to garner support for that, to convince the public, convince people here in St. Paul that it's critically important. I would see that certainly being a priority in the next 6 months. The other priority in the next 6 months, obviously, would be the transitional leadership. Any organization that's in a transition of leadership is a little time of some anxiety and so on, and it's a very critical time. So as at least in the first 6 months of the next term of the regents, that will be I don't see that as an issue, but it's an important thing to pay attention to. 6 years from now, let's hope that the funding, we're not talking about funding as much as we are now, and we're talking more about having advanced all the things that support the three legs of that stool in ways that make us all feel proud and have really contributed to the quality of life and the economic development of our state.
Okay, Billy, and then Paula Thatcher.
Okay. A lot of your experience and thinking has been in the secondary system. And that, of course, is a feeder to the University of Minnesota. How do you see your understanding of that system informing decisions that the Board of Regents will be making? I mean, as I look at it, I see they've been raising the bar kind of quietly on admissions. Mm-hmm. And could you comment on how your understanding will inform the board in making some of those decisions?
My experience in secondary education would be helpful in my role of being a positive contributor to the Board of Regents. Education, there certainly are principles that are sound in education at every level, and I think that an understanding of the pedagogy that involves what good learning, teaching and learning, it certainly transcends all levels. I've also worked a lot with higher ed in my role as a superintendent and prior to that in other administrative roles, setting up internship programs and so on with institutions of higher education, and which I think are extremely valuable and really helpful to the university students as well as to the secondary, elementary and secondary organizations that they serve. So many issues that arise in any large organization are similar, and I think that I would find that to be the case with the university and for anything from policy to personnel to you name it. There will be similar
meshing instances of the two systems so that there's more understanding among.
Well, I certainly would see that as a goal. Absolutely, yeah. I think that there. At times have been sort of a finger-pointing blame game between higher ed and elementary and secondary ed, and that's not productive. It's much more productive to work together in ways that it can enhance that. And I know the university is really interested in doing that. In fact, I've been involved in some of that with President Brunix and others. And so I know there's a very much an openness on the university to work in a very collaborative and synergistic way with K-12 education, pre-K and through 12 education, and I would look forward to that opportunity very
much.
Thank
you. That's what I was getting at.
Okay, Paul Thatcher.
Thatcher, for all of your career, at least your management, you've been the leader of the vision and the implementer of the. Of the policy that arises out of that vision, as your boards have determined from time to time. And you presumably have guarded the prerogatives of that CEO, if you would, during that period of time. And now you're asking for role reversal. Do you think you can conduct yourself way that's congruent with what you expected of your board members over time, or do you think you're going to be encroaching a little bit, or how do you see that? And as a follow-on question, totally, however, unrelated, do you think you as you think of your role in secondary education, and this is a follow-on to Billy's question. Do you think maybe it's time to step way, way, way back and to take a look at the roles and responsibilities of all the parts of our higher education system and better align them in a way that seems to be more respectful of resources and so on? If you could comment on both of those.
Well, in the first part of your question, I have such respect for so many school board members that I've worked with over the years. I have my back to the the such respect for so many board members who have given so much time and talent and energy, and the ones that I really came to treasure, if you will, as a superintendent, are those who had incredibly high expectations, had yes. Oh, of education, of just excellence in general, which of course translates to their one employee, the superintendent. And I appreciated that so much, and that when they supported one in a way that motivated you to always want to continue to improve, and always want, no matter how well things were going, you always there was this drive to be better. Just so enjoyed working with those board members. As any superintendent does, you will have a board member from time to time who see themselves as an administrator and want to decide what kind of tractor to buy for the maintenance department or whatever. that one we didn't worry about so much, but there were other things where you did worry, and it actually can bring a lot of dysfunction to an organization, and I totally understand that. I would be very sensitive to that. I do not think I would have difficulty adapting to the role of the policy developer as opposed to the implementer. I respect those differentiation a lot. If my experience can be of value in terms of a sounding board, so be it. That would be wonderful. And I always appreciated that, too, as a superintendent. You're making an administrative decision, and there's this great need to keep each other informed. You know, we like surprises, and we all want to look good in the process. And so I understand those things very well, and I could dedicate myself to the new role with success. In terms of relooking at the whole structure, absolutely. I think that it is very healthy to do that. But there's not just one model.
Is it overdue?
What's that?
Is it overdue?
Oh, I think it's overdue, absolutely. And there are some things that slowly, are evolving. I see a lot of college in the schools now and some blurring of the lines. And, of course, especially in greater Minnesota, an awful... in my town of Walker, there's a tremendous amount of taking advantage of post-secondary options So there's become a blurring between the secondary education and higher education in the past several years. But I still think there's a lot of overlap, and perhaps, we could become...
Meet with Ben Skew and some stuff.
Right. With the whole... We're so blessed in Minnesota by having... I don't think there's... I believe I'm correct in saying that we have more higher ed opportunities in Minnesota per capita than any state in the nation. Mm-hmm. There's a part of that that is wonderful, but there's another part that says, there's probably an opportunity for efficiency here, and without suffering any lack of quality and service to our constituents. And so I absolutely think that it's time to take some greater steps, perhaps, in looking at how we could maximize the resources.
In that regard, is the current system based, I'm told, and I've never checked this, On a concept that no one should be more than
35 miles
an hour away from some institution of higher learning. Is that the standard by which we got to where we are?
I think I've heard something to that effect. I wouldn't want to be quoted on that, but I think I have heard that there's some rule of thumb, at least at one point in time.
At a point in time, right.
Okay, Richard Isti and then Lois.
Many people are striving for the U to be one of the top five research centers in the world, in the United States, and that goes along with academic freedom. What is your view on academic freedom? Should it be monitored, or should it be controlled, or should it just be allowed to free flow?
Academic, easy for me to say. Academic freedom is very important to any institution of higher learning. There has to be freedom of thought, freedom of expression. If you're going to be innovative and creative, and a professor in his or her area of discipline has got to be able to challenge and pursue that course of study without feeling shackled by, you know, political concerns or you know, somebody's opinion or you know, that's in authority or whatever. Academic freedom certainly doesn't mean that you can be told that you could be inappropriate or you know, unethical, and you know, obviously there are boundaries. There are always boundaries, and they kind of should be there, but within a value system. There certainly is a need to allow people to freely pursue their discipline without somebody trying to structure what they're doing.
Lois Josephson and Paul Taylor.
You shared with us during your opening comments that you have truly made Walker your home, and added on to the cottage, and whenever somebody does that, that's good evidence. I'm wondering if you have made the absolute commitment, though, to the 8th District. And have you joined the Rotary Club yet?
No, but I joined the Lions.
Oh, and, you joined the Lions.
I joined the Lions.
That's a good
thing. And that's interesting because, you know, in many ways... In many ways, I never left the 8th District. I mean, clearly, I spent almost my entire career in the Twin City metro area. But part of my heart and head was always in the 8th District and always in Walker. I cannot even come close to estimating how many weekends and that we've gone back and forth. And as I mentioned earlier, too, in my opening statement, my wife's family is there, too. And so we've just been so closely connected with and made close friends. It was a big decision to join the Rotary Club or the Lions Club, and I almost joined both, and maybe I still will. But I have some very close friends in the Lions Club, and interesting enough, all of our fathers were Rotarians in Walker. But we did, the independent action that these sons took, I guess, was to join the Lions Club instead of the Rotary. It's the only home we have. We do not have another home at this, and I don't foresee that actually. We, believe it or not, enjoy winter up there. So we're very committed.
All right, Paul Taylor, then David Fisher.
Bob, my wife and I, and at that time our one daughter, moved to Sunny Acres. It was then Wayzata in 1969. So that school district has changed dramatically over the last 40-plus years. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the initiatives that were undertaken during your tenure as superintendent in District 284 that would help to close the achievement gap with the changing demographic population in your school district?
Yes, Paul. Probably in that regard... The biggest initiative that we entered into was the equity plan that I mentioned in my introductory statement. We worked with the West Metro Integration District, or WEMAP, something you may be familiar with, and we're an active partner. Wayzata is a voluntary member of WEMAP. Wayzata does not... contiguous with Minneapolis. If you're contiguous with Minneapolis, then you are going to be a member of WEMAP. But I can take no credit for it, but I felt very good about the fact that Wayzata joined as a voluntary member and we're part of all the desegregation efforts and so on. But in addition to that, we put an awful lot of time and energy into trying to address educational opportunity and the achievement gap. The equity plan that we adopted had many facets to it to get at anything within the organization that could be contributing to create a barrier to learning for students from any ethnic background. And I'm happy to say that 2.5 years ago, anyway, when I retired, it looked like progress was being made. We utilize the resources of the National Urban Alliance a lot, if any of you are familiar with that. There's some just good, solid teaching and learning principles that are utilized. And so we're talking about things that don't benefit every student, because they do. But we were very, very invested in that, and with the help of WEMAP, a lot of resources in that. And we, the gap was still quite large at the middle school and high school level, but we saw that gap closing significantly at the elementary level, and hopefully that's still happening. We also had devoted a lot of resources to in-service for staff, so they would be more familiar with, of course, the National Urban Alliance program and techniques, as well as trying to become more culturally aware and be able to meet the needs of students from various backgrounds in a much more effective manner. It surprises some people that Wayzata, probably higher now, but when I retired two years ago, just under 20% students of color. And most people would not guess that.
David Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Osler, I'm going to try to articulate a question. In my line of work in law, you should never ask a question you don't really answer to, but I'm going to venture down that path. The 600-pound gorilla in the room is funding, appropriate funding for schools, and it's a type of two-part question. You've been the chief administrator in four different fairly significant, sophisticated school districts, and I would be willing to bet, although this is where I'm on tender ground here, that you actually know what the per-student cost of education in those institutions were. That is, for every student there, you knew what it cost to get them educated and move on to the rest of their careers. Would it surprise you if you were to learn that the University of Minnesota has no such calculation? They don't know what the per-student cost of education is. And if you were to find that out, what would you do about it, and how would you use it?
Yeah, it would surprise me to learn that, and I take it from your question, there's probably a fact that people do not know exactly.
I only know what I'm told.
I would be certainly interested and very interested in the role of region to know more about that. Certainly, there were variations in cost. You're right. We know what it cost to educate a student. There also were great variations in that cost depending upon the student, whether you know, kind of program they were in, what kind of services they needed, and so on. It ranged by a factor of three at least, and maybe larger than that. And I would assume that might be to some degree the case at the university as well. So an average number sometimes is, you know, you really have to dig in a little bit to see, you know, what's behind that. But I think looking at those kinds of things is always helpful. It's always, why wouldn't you? There are certainly big differences between secondary and higher ed. We don't expect secondary teachers to be spending time doing research, and we certainly do at the university. It's a huge part of their role to research and publish and so on. So you're not going to have the same efficiency, quote unquote, if you just look at student teacher ratios and cost and so on. So you have to look at all those various factors. But why not look at them, and why not, you know, try to become more efficient, more effective without hampering the outcomes? It's just a common sense thing to do.
All right, Margaret, and then Paul.
15 times you took requests for funding to different groups to get it funded. I think you said 15 referendum. How did you do it, and what do you know about that's translatable for the University of Minnesota? Because they're going to people for funding constantly, the state legislature, donors, granting agencies.
I said approximately 15 because I actually tried to remember all of them. But it's very close, plus or minus two, I would say, to 15.
Good, because this is recorded and taped.
Very good. with a
a bond or operating levy can't be within a school district. There certainly are, with any fundraising, there are things that are transferable. You know, you're connecting with people and you're making a case. And that's, you know, that's the same no matter what fundraising you're talking about. And if you have a good case, and if it's an important, you know, aspect to our society that you're making the case for, people, my experience is people will support it if they can. And so that's very transferable. In terms of those levies, frankly, it was very much like a political campaign in many ways. You had a structure of citizens who filled different roles, and one of them being fundraising for the campaign, although that didn't entail too much in terms of financial need. But they, you know, identified positive voters, and they worked on getting the vote out amongst those voters, just like any candidate would work on getting the vote out amongst their constituents and their supporters. And they even set up, and I have to admit, I did prompt this structure from time to time, and you need to be careful in your role, but to actually go door to door with a block worker structure with, you know, the map of the city and divide it up and get a sense of, get people's questions answered, arm them with every question and answer you could possibly think of, and my phone number if people had more questions or other questions they couldn't answer and so on. I personally would give 40 to 50 public presentations, I think, in every one of those. I think, you know, the superintendent can't, should not take the point, if you will, on every issue, but on an issue like that, you must. When I went to St. Thomas Academy, it was really interesting to me to find out that it was different, but so similar. Because funding was still the issue, and funding was the concern. Are we going to raise enough money to run this school next year? Are we going to raise enough money for the financial aid? And you were immersed in that. So I wasn't out selling a public levy, but I was out trying to raise funds from alumni and businesses and so on. And so it was much more similar than it was different. And university, it's the same kind of thing. You know, I know that the university has a very successful foundation. I know that the basic tenets are the same, and obviously my role as superintendent and the potential roles of regent would involve lobbying, I would assume, and I've certainly done a fair amount of that as well in terms of trying to raise funds for that purpose.
Okay. Paul Thatcher.
Doctor, David's question about metrics reminds me of a former board member of the Board of Regents, I think you were the chairman, who in his early days discovered a number in the monthly reports of the number of employees. And he thought it might be helpful if they had that comparison for other institutions for comparative metrics. And so on. He noticed the next month the response was to simply drop the number out of reports. It no longer was there. It's apparently not been there since. But it suggests to me that there are such things as best practice, and there are such things as metrics and so on, and we always have to be sure that we've got apples with apples and oranges with oranges for comparison's sake. But as a board member of the Board of Regents, would you think it's important for we need metrics and by which we can judge what's going on and how we're doing and or not? Would you think that would be appropriate?
Absolutely. I think it's very appropriate. I
you assume they're doing it, even?
I know they're doing it because I've done a little work and research myself in trying to see what kinds of metrics the university has been doing and what are the components of the strategic positioning initiative and so on that's been going on for 4 or 5 years now, and what kind of metrics are used to measure the success of initiatives that are involved with that. And they're very, you know, they're very appropriate. There certainly has, as we mentioned earlier, been a very, very concerted effort to raise the bar for the undergraduate program, and it's been very obvious, and it's been very successful from my perspective.
starting with the elimination of the general college, which was somewhat controversial. But I know that the ACT and SAT scores of the incoming freshman class are much higher now than they were several years ago, and that I think is a good thing. The university has a role to play within this umbrella of higher ed opportunities that we afford the citizens of our state, a very critical role, but it doesn't have to be everything to everybody. It shouldn't be. You need to focus on what's your role and focus on doing that exceptionally well. And the university has done a better and better job of that. And so the metrics of what that incoming class looks like, trying to increase the four-year graduation rate, which is, I know it's proven to be, I think it was about 20% 4 or 5 years ago, and now it's up closer to 40 or 50%. Which is wonderful, to measure the number of students involved with research at the undergraduate level. That's something I wasn't aware of, frankly, until I became interested in this opportunity. And to know that close to 50%, I believe it is now, of undergraduate students get mentored in a research role by professors, I find absolutely fantastic. I think it's just wonderful. When I was teaching biology many years ago, when I went to graduate school at the University of Virginia, I learned that there was a real dearth of people going into science back in those days, and it was right after Sputnik and all that, which allowed me to go to the University of Virginia, which was nice. But the National Science Foundation supported a lot of things because of the emphasis on that back in those days. But I was really disturbed to learn that students were not going into science because they wanted to do something creative. And I thought, my gosh, what an indictment of how we're teaching science. So I am back to Aiden Perry determined to change that, at least in one small little part of the world, and created a second-year biology course that became very popular, which was great, and where it was totally research-based. And I have to tell you, the professors at the University of Minnesota were so connected with students from my class. Several of them were over here often, every year, on various research projects that I was just trying to keep many balls in the air with students at the university and on the roof of the school or wherever else, literally. But I remember saying to those students, you know, you're not going to get a chance to do this again until grad school. And I was so delighted to see that that's not true anymore, at least not at the University of Minnesota. So I digress, but it's such a passion for me then, and still, as you can probably tell. But to measure, you know, those kinds of things and see how things are improving, to I think metrics that you know, looking at the research funding and it, you know, is it increasing, and are we getting the bang for the buck from the research funds we get, and are we clearly have to go after research funds with the private sector, but are we keeping a proper relationship where the research isn't tainted in any way, shape, or form as a part of that relationship? And the outreach programs and the percentage of citizens in our state that are involved in extension and other types of outreach, which are so wonderful. And in the end, just assessing, are we moving towards that, I think it's admittedly audacious goal of being one of the top three public research universities in the world.
But in regard to metrics, if I may just last lesson, in regard to metrics, it's been suggested to me even just in the last week that the university would strategically decide to drop certain things and slough them off, as in terms of our earlier kind of conversation. Their metrics would vastly improve as a result of that. And as a political thing, as a public relations thing, In terms of funding at the legislature and so on, though it might otherwise not make any sense, it might be a very smart and strategic thing to do. Should those kinds of things be thought about and considered?
Absolutely, they should be thought about and considered. There are many considerations you have to take into account in making any decision, and pros and cons. But to eliminate a program that serves a need well,
I meant to give it some, or put it someplace else, not to eliminate it, like giving it to some minsky.
Oh, I see. Sorry. so their metrics go down, and your person goes up. You'd be real. Be very careful with that.
It's very possible. I have a friend the other day who sent me an email, and he said that when he moved from Georgia to Alabama, that both states' IQ went up.
Okay, Richard. No.
Joke. My question is: forget you. The university has a stated vision of being one of the top public research institutions, universities in the world, actually. And of course, we have it. My first part of the question is: do you think that continues to be a worthy goal? And what role do you see the Board of Regents has in creating, staying with that vision or creating a new one, particularly with the new president coming in? How do you do all that? Because that's a pretty major deal for the university, having that vision. It drives all that they do.
Well, I think the university, I think Dr. Bernix and others have stated openly that, yes, this is an audacious goal, I think is the word that was used. And I struggle a little bit with, you know, in goal setting, you know, do you set a goal that you know you can realistically meet in a certain, you know, manageable time frame? Just how audacious should you get? But to set your sights high and to want to be an exceptional institution is absolutely necessary, laudable, admirable, and I would support totally. Whether it's top three or top five or top, you know, but to be amongst the top and to be always striving to continually improve and move in that direction is absolutely critically important. Argue till whenever about whether it's top three or whether that's, you know, or even how you judge some of those things is a little subjective at times, but to always be shooting for that, something like that, that you must be doing. You must do that. And how you contribute to that as a regent would be to be supportive of that vision and to try to be supportive to the administration, faculty, and staff, if you can, to give them the tools to actually be able to achieve that. There's nothing worse than having an organization adopt a goal and then not give the people who have to do the work to meet that goal and not give them the resources necessary to actually accomplish it, because that's not fair to anyone.
Well, they have a new president coming in, so how do you see, maybe they might have a different vision or a different goal, or how do you... What do you think ought to happen there?
Well, he probably will. Hopefully, will have some different thoughts. You know, and that's healthy to an organization to have a new perspective, different thoughts. But as I mentioned in my introductory statement, I have been in the role that he's going to be in four times. You know, we didn't have 18,000 employees, but we had, you know, 1,800 or so, and. So it's a big deal, this transition, and I really think it's a critical time, and he will have his own ideas, he will have his own personality, but I think he has to be careful, and the Board of Regents has to be careful, everyone has to be careful, not to push him, and nor should he feel that he's pushed in trying to do too much too soon. It's critically important, I think, to not make any major decisions until you understand that institution thoroughly and understand why what exists, why things are done the way they're done. Until you understand that history and have read and absorbed everything you possibly can, and most importantly, created the relationships with everyone you're going to have to create a relationship with in order to lay the groundwork to do things. You know, the pressure shouldn't be there. And if a regent or if that person internally even is putting too much pressure on, I would certainly want to try to, you know, steer that in a different direction, because it takes a long time to successfully go through a transition.
Okay, George Sundstrom, please.
Mr. Oslin, as a representative of the 8th District, do you see anything unique to the 8th District, different or unique to the mission of the university, for instance, in the 8th District?
I don't think anything unique in the 8th District. The 8th District, at least a good portion of the 8th District, is economically not as wide. I wouldn't say depressed, but there are more students that would have financial need, let's say, out of the 8th District than some other districts. So the 8th District, I think, has a little bigger stake in the financial aid structure of the university, which allowing, you know, 8th District students to attend university. That's certainly from an economic development standpoint, there might be some certain industries that could be helped in the 8th District in some way, shape, or form that might be somewhat unique. But for the most part, I don't think. I asked that question of Representative Larry Hollis, who was just a few hundred feet from me, actually, and here a couple weeks ago. Is there anything different about the 8th District in terms of the university and needs and priorities? And he didn't think so. I might learn something that would change my mind on that, but I don't see anything dramatic there.
Okay. Would you like to make a closing statement?
Well, I would just reiterate my appreciation for the opportunity to meet with you today. I'm very excited about the potential to serve as a regent. I do think that it's such a critical institution to the future of our state and such a big driver of our economy and human welfare in the future. And so to be involved with that, I would find humbling and also, a great honor and something I would dedicate any bit of talent or experience that I have to trying to add a positive aspect to. And I also want to thank you for your dedication to the university by your willingness to dedicate your time and effort and energy to this process. It's exceptional on your part, and we really appreciate it as a citizen of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.